Oh my goodness, this is terrible, right? The hackers are using these open source tools and they're running at a great speed. I mean, I don't want to tell you how you do your job, people, but maybe you should use the same tools and use the models. And rather than saying, you know, hey, please, you are a security researcher, maybe be a security researcher with the tools and agentic AI and actually do the test first, right?
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most interesting stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today, Ryan Anschutz, North America leader of X-Force Incident Response, Evelyn Anderson, CSS CTO, IBM Distinguished Engineer, IBM Master Inventor, Seth Glasgow, Cyber Range Executive Advisor, and our special guest for the first segment, Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer and frequent presence on Mixture of Experts, IBM's AI news podcast, for those of you who have not already subscribed to that one. This week, we're going to be talking about OWASP's top 10 for 2025, big changes in the ransomware landscape, and the ongoing debate over the efficacy of cyber insurance. But first, a story I'm sure we've all heard by now, Anthropic disrupted an AI-powered espionage campaign. Now, according to Anthropic, hackers were using Claude Code to mount an assault against some 30 targets, with the AI handling 80 to 90% of the campaign, that's the number that they put on it, including recon, writing exploit code, establishing backdoors, exfiltrating data, all this stuff with almost no human input. And reactions have been kind of mixed, actually. Some people look at this and they say, oh my God, this is crazy. I can't believe that the attackers are utilizing this stuff this way. I can't believe we've gotten to this point in the cyber attack era. Other people are looking at it and saying, this seems a bit sensational. I'm not really sure that this is as impressive as Anthropic is making it sound. For example, Anthropic themselves noted that while the attackers were targeting some 30 organizations, they only succeeded in, quote, a small number of cases. So I want to start by throwing it to you, Chris, as the resident AI guy here. On that scale from holy crap to snooze fest, where are you landing with this thing and why?
Highly predictable. But the first thing I would say when people say, you know, the AI is going to cause a lot of job loss, who would have thought it would be the hackers first, you know? So there we go. It is highly predictable. I mean, if we actually look at the Anthropic paper there, I think there's a couple of key things we need to point out. First thing is it was Claude Code that they used. It wasn't Claude in that sense. I mean, Claude, its model, was backing it, but it was Claude Code. And that is actually super important because the real key to this is about tool orchestration. So they used a whole bunch of open source tools, right? And there's a whole community of MCP servers. You know, they said they used one for browser automation. I could take a fair guess that that was probably Playwright. But again, same sort of thing. They've just taken a load of open source tools, made that available. Probably, and I'm no cybersecurity person, but probably the same tools that you folks use every day. And all they've done is they've exposed that to Claude Code in a way. And I think that is the key thing. It is agentic. So AI is now officially a script, KD people. So that's what's going on. So I'm not surprised because tool calling is the key piece. I think what I would say is this has now opened the can of worms, right? And, you know, and they're saying Claude Code, well, you know, we're going to protect the Claude model. We're going to do a lot better in that.
Yeah, I can absolutely see it going that way. And let's throw then to a cybersecurity take on this one, right? And let's go to you, Evelyn. Where do you fall on this scale from holy crap to, you know, totally expected?
It was more so just interesting to me. I mean, when I first looked at it, I looked at it as, yes, it's a new challenge for us from a cybersecurity perspective, but I also view it as an opportunity. You know, the fact that the hackers have kind of beat us to thinking about how you can start writing code to, you know, address a lot of their phishing campaigns, their deep fakes, you know, malware, et cetera, we can actually do the same thing. My particular team has been working on building out what they call adaptive AI governance. And the purpose of it is to be more proactive than reactive. But the key word is we're building it. It doesn't exist yet. And what this is actually telling me, and, you know, the blaring sign that I see is we have to move faster. We have to look at how we can implement AI-driven security architectures, as well as governance, to be more to adopt across, you know, our entire ecosystem versus us waiting until we detect a problem and finding it. We need to be more autonomous, that once we see that someone has gone in, whether it was intentional or unintentional, and changed the system configuration, that we don't wait and take it through, you know, the five whys, did it happen? But we have programs in place to actually flip it back to what it should be. So for me, when I looked at this, it just made me think about all the things in areas where we need to accelerate on.
Absolutely. And that brings up a good point, right? Sometimes I look at some of this stuff and I wonder if the hackers are moving a lot faster with this stuff than the kind of legitimate use cases are. Ryan, I see you nodding. What are your thoughts there? Do you think the hackers have a kind of leg up on us right now?
Yeah, I would say this is pretty challenging because, you know, for this case in particular, what really stood out to me was the automation of actually the full kill chain. It was everything from recon, exploit generation, backdoor deployment, and data theft. You know, in their numbers, that 80 to 90% of that was done autonomously. So that really proves that this is not just theoretical anymore. And I don't know if sensationalizing is a good word. This is kind of pretty scary. But in the same breath, this is the first time the public has actually seen what we in IR have actually been quietly preparing for. And that is an adversary that really doesn't sleep, that doesn't take weekends and iterates at true machine speed. So for IR teams, really, this shifts the game. We now have to really detect and contain not just our human counterparts, our human adversaries, but machine speed adversaries.
And the interesting thing about that kind of machine speed adversary is that it might move a lot faster than us, but it also makes some mistakes that people don't make, right? One of the things that Anthropic brought up in their report was that, you know, Claude Code did hallucinate a couple times, right? They saw it spitting out some fake credentials that didn't actually work, right? Or claiming it had surfaced data that was actually just public data. I'm wondering how this factors into our assessment of the threat. Seth, any thoughts on your end there?
Yeah, I think it does kind of matter because it does still have a lot of the same limitations that an LLM normally would. It can hallucinate. It's only as good as what it's trained on. But additionally, you know, Claude Code is sort of a legitimate tool, right? It was essentially socially engineered, and I believe the full paper actually uses that term to describe how could the legitimate tool be used to do something that was destructive. Well, they set up a pretext that they, the attackers, were themselves a security research company and then leveraged it to get it to do these things sort of against it. And so a lot of what we work with clients on is sort of, hey, how does AI change what these attack avenues are? And this is similarly, you know, sort of the old attack avenue of I've convinced you to do something. It's social engineering. But now, as Ryan said, it's at machine speed, right? The scale, the speed, the scope of how quickly this can be done, if I'm still just convincing something to do it, that does materially change how bad that can be, right? And so even though it's going to be wrong, you know, that ethical limitation of if I'm the attacker, do I care that it's wrong? Probably not, right? I don't have the same governance structures when I'm on the other side of the law that I would on, you know, a legitimate side.
Seth, I'm really glad you brought up that social engineering perspective because you're right, right? This all had to, the way that this worked was the Claude Code was jailbroken, right? You had to kind of, or not jailbroken necessarily, but you had to trick it basically, right? Make it think it was doing something legitimate. Chris, I was wondering if you could give us some insight into how easy it is to kind of trick these AI models into doing things they shouldn't. I mean, how are our guardrails? What's the kind of level of sophistication there?
I think these days it's getting pretty sophisticated. I mean, there tends to be guard models surrounding the main model anyway. But the reality is it's very difficult to tell when something is role-playing. And that's really what happened in this case. It was a role-play type attack versus doing it for reals. Maybe a bit of a clue is you gave access to the tools and it was sitting hacking on your behalf. So that might be the point where you might say, you know what, we're beyond role-playing at that point. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I just don't think that this is necessarily a solved problem. So if you look at folks like Pliny, for example, who's always publishing the kind of the how to prompt engineer around these models, then most of this stuff is out there in the open. I guess what I would say just to counter things is everybody's going, oh my goodness, this is terrible, right? The hackers are using these open source tools and they're running at a great speed. I mean, I don't want to tell you how you do your job, people, but maybe you should use the same tools and use the models. And rather than saying, you know, hey, please, you are a security researcher, maybe be a security researcher with the tools in agentic AI and actually do the test first, right? So use the very same tools to do that. Because the reality is, if you don't have any vulnerabilities that are going to come up from these open source tools, then you're not going to be hacked by these folks. So I think there is an argument for security teams to actually start doing that preventative measures, use the exact same techniques as the hackers. It's all laid out in the paper from Anthropic. It's actually a really pretty well detailed paper on that. So go follow that and just do it in advance.
I think that's a really good point. You know, honestly, like adopting that research, adopting that hacking technique kind of as your own research method. And I'm wondering if any of the folks here have toyed around with that stuff or toyed around with agentic AI or anything really in your kind of security work. Kind of open question. Has anybody toyed with that stuff? Anything they want to talk about on that front?
Yeah, I think I can touch on that a little bit. You know, just how like attackers are chaining those models together, like you mentioned, Chris. You know, defenders, we are actually, you know, chaining together defensive agents, one model monitoring logs, another doing memory forensics, another isolating hosts, and, you know, maybe another actually even drafting executive updates. You know, that's where this all goes. It's kind of turning those defensive models and fighting fire with fire, essentially, as you mentioned before. So that is something that as defenders, we are constantly evolving every day with.
Yeah, and we're not actually doing the same thing as Ryan, but we're doing things where we're utilizing agentic AI to perform like some auto analysis and reasoning. We are responsible for all of the regulations, frameworks, et cetera, that come in. So when you think about the huge number of regulations and laws across the globe, when we're working with our clients, we have to be able to pull out the controls and make sure that the client is meeting their regulatory commitments. And so we're doing analysis there where our engine today is able to go in, analyze, perform some auto reasoning, and then respond to like any type of an assessment. So that's how we're utilizing it within our arena. But we're also helping to build it where we're building a knowledge engine that will be able to establish a baseline for a client and then assess the client against that baseline, not only for their controls, but for the risk model, for their governance structure, their strategy, et cetera.
But so it seems like the overall kind of perspective here is that, right, we all kind of saw this coming, but it's still a big deal. But we're working on some stuff on our end as defenders to kind of put these tools to the same kinds of uses. And eventually we're going to start entering into, I don't know, maybe a fully automated, sort of security world where the hackers are attacking the agents and the agents are attacking the hacker agents. I don't know. You don't even need people there anymore. It's fully automated cyber attacks. It's great. Last question, though, and this is kind of, this is just something I saw that I wanted to bring up. I saw one tweet about this where somebody was very skeptical of what Anthropic was reporting. And they said, they asked how Anthropic could get what they called, quote unquote, AGI level performance out of this stuff. I wanted to throw this to the actual AI guy here. Does anything like this look like AGI to you at all? Because it didn't to me.
It's definitely not AGI. This is, I mean, as I said before, the real innovation on this is the fact that the models are getting really good at tool calling, right? And they're also getting really good at planning. They are the two things. So if you look at some of the weaker models, they're like your script kiddies. They'll just call any old tool and hope something lands, right? But a really good big model that can tool call will be able to follow up. It'll follow sequence events. It'll have a plan in the same way as a human being is. So this isn't about how great the AI is. And it is, in some regards, it is about how great the AI is, because Claude is a great model and Claude Code is a wonderful tool. But it's really this advances in function call and this advances in planning that's made this possible. And it's really about the tools. The more tools that you give access to the model, right? So if you can look at all of your security tools that you use today, the hack and all the script kiddies use, et cetera, if you get all of those same tools, you make them available with something like MCP servers and or just wrap them in function calls, then you're going to be able to have AI do the same thing, because it's not really applying so much intelligence there. It's using the tools to break through and then gather the insights. So anybody who's done any sort of vibe coding or done any sort of agentic work whatsoever will recognize the techniques here.
Yeah. So I know it's been mentioned a couple of times around script kiddies, and I think that is concerning. If you look historically, some of the world's worst breaches weren't actually done by elite threat actors. They were done by beginners using downloaded tools and historically old vulnerabilities. Now imagine those same beginners with access to autonomous AI agents. That is the trajectory that actually should concern us.
That's a really good point, right? Because I think, especially when we have these conversations about AI, there's a tendency to focus on how impressive the tool itself is, but it's really important what it's enabling people to do, right? And it's like you said, a script kiddie with one of these things in their hands, they become very good at that stuff. And you didn't even need to be that good in the first place, right? You know what I mean? Like you said, some of the biggest attacks in history were the script kiddies. So I think that's a really important point. On that note, I think it's time to move on to our next story. But thank you, Chris, for being here, for talking through this stuff with the rest of us. Go watch Mixture of Experts if you haven't already, folks.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's move on to our second story for today. This is OWASP's top 10 for 2025. Now, last week, OWASP released the latest installment of its top 10 list of the most critical web application security risks. This is the 8th installment of the list overall, I believe, and the first update since 2021. Some highlights are broken access control remains the number one threat. Security misconfigurations rose from number 5 to number 2, and two new ones joined the list. We've got software supply chain failures and mishandling of exceptional conditions. So first off, I just want to get initial reactions to this update. You know, I know a lot of us kind of use OWASP as a guide for when we're designing or working on web apps, so I just want to see how people are feeling about this newest iteration. Let's start with you, Seth. Any initial reactions, things that caught your eye here, thoughts that come to mind?
Yeah, I actually really like the addition of the exceptional conditions sort of catch, right? Because a lot of it is focusing on these unique failure points that exist within a certain context or, you know, in usual customer applications, we're thinking of the business logic, right? And so we've actually seen kind of sometimes on the testing side, you have sort of what is old is new again in terms of these vibe-coded apps that are bringing in old business logic flaws that we thought we had kind of taken care of, right? So it's not perfect, right? The overall OWASP idea of categorizing CWEs versus specifics, the way MITRE does it, is a point of contention. But the idea that this category exists to acknowledge that there are just conditions that have been mishandled but don't necessarily have a standard way to handle is extremely important in putting the apps in the business and user context, right? How is it being used that can be abused, as opposed to just a rote coding issue?
Yeah, I'm glad you kind of explicated on that, right? Because you just see that phrase, mishandling of exceptional conditions. And if you're a guy like me who's not super technical, you're like, what the heck does that mean? So I'm glad you put that into context where it's like, oh, that's super duper important. Evelyn, what about you? Any thoughts on this new OWASP list? Anything jump to mind when you look at it?
It was a little bit kind of, well, I was surprised, I guess, in one sense, because I haven't actually looked at the OWASP top 10 in a couple of years. And I was like, wow, it hasn't changed a lot, which is disappointing that we should have improved over the last 5 years. When I saw that, you know, broken access control still holding that top spot very strongly there. So I was a little bit disappointed that there hasn't been any that much improvement within the market there. But I was happy to see supply chain. When it comes to supply chain, you know, we're starting to realize that our clients are realizing the growing risk around their vendors and, you know, the third nth party vendors and how it actually impacts. And we're starting to see more and more coming out around this space. When we've been looking at it, you know, most of the clients, their biggest complaint and concern now is how those third party, fourth party, nth party, whatever vendors actually have on their organization and what, you know, portions of their supply chain that they're actually supporting. And if they go down or if there's, you know, any type of a problem, a breach with them, how it impacts their overarching brand. So I was very pleasantly surprised to see the supply chain there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that basically every episode we've recorded of this show so far has included some reference to a supply chain attack or somebody talking about supply chain. It really is kind of top of mind for a lot of people. For, like you said, you know, organizations are worried. They're integrated with so many other companies. And if a third party gets breached, it can affect them. And what's that going to do? And not to harp on it, but also we were just talking in the last section about, you know, these AI agents chaining together a bunch of tools. I mean, that's even more of a supply chain right there that you're getting open up to. So I agree. I'm glad to see that here, too. Ryan, how about you? Anything come to mind when you look at this list?
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with Evelyn. You know, this new OWASP list really feels like a reality check for the AI coding era, where this is not just a developer list anymore. It's really a map of how attackers are breaking into modern environments, where that big theme, that insecure design, right? That API exposure, the dependency chain risks that we've been talking about, and really AI-generated code are now first-class citizens on this list, right? What's interesting, though, is this speed. This list already feels like it will need updates mid-year, right? Like, our attack surface is already expanding faster than our ability to train dev teams. And from my lens on that incident response aspect, I like how OWASP is really kind of becoming predictive. Like, the list is almost a forecast of the types of vulnerabilities we're actually cleaning up in breaches every day.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, you know, when you talk about how it feels like it's a list that almost is going to be needed to be updated pretty soon, right? Because, you know, you also look at what Evelyn said before about how a lot of this stuff looks pretty similar to how it used to, right? And it raises this kind of question for me where it's like, we're in this AI coding era, and yet how much things have changed. They're also not that different in some ways, right? Like, it's weird how the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I don't know, that's just something that came to mind there. And I wonder, I guess, I don't know, maybe the rise of vibe coding makes some of this stuff more likely to be there, right? Because people who aren't used to coding apps are coding apps now. I don't know, just a thought that I'm throwing out there. But so anyway, you as the security experts here, as you look at this and you highlight the things that jump to mind for you, what do you think the takeaways are for defenders, right? Like, if you're a defender, for example, Ryan, you're talking about the need to train people, for example. If you're a defender sitting there, what should you be, based on this list, thinking about as your kind of next moves? How should this influence what you do next? Let's go back around the circle. Seth, any thoughts there, what the key takeaways for defenders are?
Yeah, so I think the fact that security misconfiguration jumped from 5 to 2 tells you a lot about where attackers are focusing and where we need to focus as defenders, right? New vulnerabilities will always be novel. We will find 0 days. We have to respond to that. But we have a lot of control over those configuration items, and that's what we need to clamp down, right? And so in the application space, it's because more and more of these apps are managed by these configurations, we have to put more sort of vigilance around how they're created, right? We're probably using AI to generate some of those configurations as well. So really focusing on that, you know, in a traditional network environment, a lot of times what's getting exploited is nothing new. It's the same old Active Directory misconfigurations as well. And I think a lot of times it's those security configurations are thorny. They can be very difficult to work through. And so you really have to focus on that. And I think it jumping from 5 to 2 just tells you that that is growing and increasing attack space. And from my perspective, if I were the attacker, yeah, I would love to try to get in there because that's probably going to have a flaw that I can make a use of that doesn't require me being more novel on the actual vulnerability or inject side.
Fully agree with what Seth mentioned there. I guess when I looked at this, I started thinking about, you know, the prior session where we were discussing how attackers were getting into the environment. And when I'm looking at broken access control and system misconfiguration, I look at both of those as being two key areas of opportunity where we can try to automate. I mean, if we are, you know, making mistakes every time we're configuring a system, then let's try to automate that process. I mean, there's no reason why we can't actually automate it. And it's one of the areas that I think we have to closely look at, you know, how do we migrate to more of a digital worker versus a human actually doing it and, you know, just have a validation process from a human. And if necessary, establish a secondary control where we go back and check the, you know, the initial configuration from the initial setup. So I think that this is an area that we can definitely improve in. We just have to start thinking a little bit out of the box.
I love that. I love that. Ryan, how about you? What are your takeaways?
I go back to, like, you know, the defenders, right? This list really, I think, reflects the reality that defenders live in every day. You know, as we mentioned before, that insecure design, API exposure, and misconfigs, you know, that is what really drives the majority of the breaches, not exotic exploits. You know, with AI now really producing a significant chunk of enterprise code, I think we need stronger guardrails, better code lineage, and better real-time validation. I think that the key takeaway really for defenders is simple: focus on the fundamentals, secure the dev pipeline, and gain that deep visibility into your APIs and identity flows.
Yeah, you know, I think if there was like one cardinal rule of cybersecurity that's come up again in almost every episode we talk about, it's focus on the fundamentals. You know, as much as things change, so much stays the same. Let's move on then to our next story here. Now, a new report from Checkpoint Research found that the ransomware landscape has grown much more fragmented, with the large gangs losing their traditional grip on power and many smaller gangs accounting for a bigger share of attacks. Specifically, some of the numbers they call out here was that in Q3 2025, they saw 85 active ransomware and extortion gangs, which was the most decentralized, that's the word they use, the most decentralized ransomware ecosystem that they've seen since Checkpoint has been, you know, keeping tabs on this thing. Earlier this year, the top 10 ransomware gangs accounted for 71% of victims. That has since fallen to 56%. So, you know, again, we're seeing that share decrease. And the Checkpoint says that this fragmentation is driven by the kind of dissolution of large gangs following successful law enforcement efforts, right? We've seen quite a bit of you know, gangs get taken down this year by law enforcement. There are a lot of good activity there. But often what happens is that these gangs get taken down. Some people scatter, they form their own. And so now we've got a bunch of little guys running around out there. I'm wondering how this situation, all these little guys popping up, complicates that threat landscape as opposed to when you're dealing with a bunch of big ransomware gangs. Let's start with you, Seth. Any thoughts on how this complicates the threat landscape for organizations?
Yeah, I think first off, the minute that the larger ones break up, now we have sort of a dearth of intelligence, right? We don't know exactly. We can't attribute behaviors to a bunch of different small groups. And furthermore, the small groups, if they start to target more specific industries, well, their tactics will likely become more effective while they get sort of hyper niche. The report itself actually mentioned something that I found interesting around how this ecosystem that's evolving mirrors sort of a decentralized financial system or open source communities. And we see that a lot with the way these threat actors work now, right? Hey, my core competency is credential theft. I'll sell these off to another group who is good at this. And so as it sort of fragments, it creates a sort of structure organizationally that is not unlike the way that we naturally structure legitimate organizations, right? Now, they're not governed by the same things, but ultimately these criminal organizations, for the most part, have the same goal as our organizations, which is they desire to make money and turn a profit, right? So many of them, as they split up, are going to be harder to track and really focus in and sort of being, hey, if I'm a smaller fish, I'm harder to gobble up. It probably makes them able to survive and become survivable better themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? That kind of dark web marketplace, those dynamics, that economics is very similar to the legitimate marketplace, right? Like you said, the same kinds of pressures are there. At the end of the day, we're talking about people who are there after money, they're after profit, right? It just so happens that they don't have as many scruples down in the dark web as the rest of us do up here. But I do think that's a good point, right? How much these things mirror each other. You know, and another interesting thing about it is that this breakup and this change in market dynamics, like you said, it gives us a dearth of intelligence, and it also gives the victims kind of some hesitation in terms of, do I want to pay these guys? Because it turns out that they're seen as a lot less trustworthy than the big guys, which is a very interesting question about branding, right? The big guys have an incentive to decrypt when they say they're going to decrypt, right? Because that gets people to pay them. The little guys have less of an incentive. And that means people are a little more hesitant about paying them. I'm wondering, Evelyn, if you have any thoughts about this particular dynamic, dealing with these ransom demands from these little groups that you're not even sure of if they're going to deliver on their promises.
I actually, you know, I was listening to Seth and thinking about when you first go through this and you think about decentralizing hackers, I mean, you know, attacks into organizations, it's beyond terrifying when you think about, okay, my niche, my skill is not here. So I'm just going to sell, I can sell off the different bits and pieces to other groups that may have their specialty. I mean, I agree with the smaller, you know, accounts and organizations where they're a little bit hesitant to pay because there's no incentive. And when you're talking about a little guy, okay, we're with this group today. Oh, you caught one of us. Okay, we just branch out the next day and we start a new group, you know, and on and on and on. And so when I looked at this and I thought about the conversations we had, you know, many years ago when we thought about just decentralizing different bits and pieces of cybersecurity, and I'm like, wow, we're decentralizing attacks now. This is like beyond terrifying for me when you start thinking about it. And the biggest thing is, how do you catch up? You know, there's so much uncertainty and volatility in the process until when you think about the law enforcement being able to take them down, they may get one, but, you know, that's the problem. They get one, but then there's nine others that just moved, changed locations and started up again. So for me, when I looked at it and went through the article, it was like, wow, how do you catch up with this? Because it's going to be difficult.
Now, I'm glad you brought up that question of catching up, because that's what was running through my head, too, right? Is that, like, how do you, like, when you take down one organization and a bunch of little ones pop up, it almost feels like, what was the point of taking down the big one? And maybe it's unfair, but I'm going to pose the question and I'm going to throw it to you, Ryan. Are we just destined to deal with this? Is this just what's going to happen where you take down a big organization and the little ones are going to pop up? Like, is this just the dynamic and we have to accept it and adjust to it? Or I don't know, is there a more definite way to shut down some of this stuff? I don't know. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, I kind of go back to prior to my time in cyber, I spent many years in law enforcement. And I think this is something where we have to, what we always say in law enforcement was adapt and overcome, right? And if we take a look at what fragmentation does of criminal organizations, it kind of destroys that traditional law enforcement playbook, right? The big gangs have hierarchy. They have infrastructure, they have predictable patterns, they have financial trails. You track them like an organized crime enterprise. But when we see these micro crews spinning up overnight using disposable infrastructure and disappearing just as fast, and to Evelyn, your point, there's no brand to track. So, you know, victims are kind of left with, hey, who are we dealing with? There's no negotiation history, no crypto wallet reuse. It's the proverbial whack-a-mole at global scale, right? So that is a complexity that we have to just adapt and overcome with. I think really from IR, you know, since we can't rely on known group patterns and law enforcement can't either, that really, it's unfortunate because it does prolong investigations, I think, unnecessarily, and also complicates victim recovery. So we have to really find a way to adapt and overcome those challenges.
So to close out this segment, I want to play a quick game of Would You Rather, because I cannot help myself whenever the opportunity arises to play a quick game of Would You Rather. So I'm going to go around real quick. Would you rather deal with lots of little gangs running around or just a couple big ones? Seth, what do you think?
I think it's kind of twofold. I think it's probably easier from the defensive side to deal with a couple of known players, right? As Ryan said, you can get tendencies on them. The intel's easier to track. We have a way to understand how they will behave because they behave in a way that we understand. A bunch of smaller ones is probably worse, but it's the same as anything in terms of this is still just crime, right? Sweep one street corner, they're going to move to other ones. It's just kind of a repeat fashion that we have to overcome. But I think it would be easier to deal with larger players as opposed to a bunch of unique smaller ones.
I agree. When it comes to the larger players, I think that, you know, they're a little bit more predictable and they have, you know, a structured approach. And so you can kind of be able to understand a little bit of their behaviors. So for me, it would definitely be a larger. I think the smaller, as we mentioned, are unpredictable. And I think the whack-a-mole is what stuck in my brain from Ryan. I think that's the best description is you're really trying to whack-a-mole with the smaller. So definitely larger.
Absolutely. And Ryan, take us home.
Yeah, give me the big ransomware cartel any day over the small crews. The big guys are predictable, professionalized, and they usually actually follow their own rules. The smaller crews, they are chaotic, emotional, and heck, they might even burn down the entire environment by accident.
So I take it there will be no Small Business Saturday for the ransomware gangs this year. Let's move on then to our final story for the week. Insurance payments for cyber attacks are skyrocketing in the UK. UK cyber insurers reported that in 2024, they spent $259 million on payouts compared to $77 million in 2023, which is just a massive year-over-year leap. And that doesn't even account for some of those huge attacks we saw in 2025, like the JLR attack that took them offline for like, I don't know, a month and a half or something, right? So this figure has added more fuel to an ongoing debate in cybersecurity corners. Does cyber insurance help strengthen defenses, or does it just encourage hackers to keep asking for ransoms? I'm going to start with you, Evelyn. Do you have any thoughts on this debate about cyber insurance? And I recognize we might not be able to land on one side cleanly, but I'd just like to hear your take.
For me, when I went through the article and read and thought about it a little bit. For me, you know, when you think about cyber insurance, it's just like us having insurance. It's a safety net. You don't predict that, you know, there's going to be a tornado that comes through and wipes out your house. But just in case, you're just trying to recover your expenses. And so when I look at this particular scenario, we see, I mean, the numbers don't lie. We see in our own cost of a data breach, the report where we're seeing the numbers just going up and away. Insurance payments are going to go up with it. You know, when you start looking at a lot of the premiums and you're weighing the difference, it's one of those, okay, how much is this worth, or am I willing to come out of my pocket and pay to an attacker directly from, you know, my funds versus let me have some insurance. And if you look at the return on investment, the insurance paying out X number of millions of dollars or versus the organization, I think you have to look at both and go with both. But the one thing what I was looking at when I thought about this is that there's still an impact to their reputation. You know, the reputational brand is still, when you look and weigh the differences, if I know that a company was able to recover versus if I'm dealing, you know, and I have business with a company and they're not able to recover because they didn't have insurance and, you know, this particular event wiped them out, and, you know, they're holding on by a thread versus one that had insurance and was able to recover, I think I'd always go with the one that had insurance, that planned for the rainy day, you know, when the storm came through and took everything. The storm being the hackers.
Makes sense. Ryan, how about you? Any thoughts here?
Yeah, I have a slightly different look into that. I really think that when insurance payouts triple in 1 year, I think it tells you two clear things. I think the attacks are more severe and organizations are actually still not building resilience at the pace that the threats are actually evolving. When I reading this article, I think the interesting part really is the insurers are becoming unofficial regulators. They're demanding proof of controls, evidence of IR readiness, tabletop prep, multi-factor authentication everywhere. Immutable backups. And if you don't have it, your coverage shrinks and your premiums skyrocket, right? So that insurance is almost that, it's no longer a safety net anymore. It's now shaping cybersecurity maturity programs. And what does that mean for organizations? I mean, that means during a breach, your timeline, your containment speed, and documentation aren't just operational. They literally directly impact your financial recovery.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's one of the things that people, you know, sparks this debate right in the first place is like, should cyber insurers be these like unofficial regulators, you know? Like, is that the right thing to do? And I don't know that we can necessarily answer it, but it's food for thought. Seth, your take on this little debate here.
Yeah, I mean, it's in terms of if it should exist or what it does, does having insurance on any of our goods promote burglary, right? The insurance exists because the crime occurs and the loss happens. It's not like the insurance exists first. So it exists because there exists a world where we have losses from this. But in general, they do require these baselines. And as Ryan said, it's becoming this de facto private regulation of if you want to have coverage, we need you to do X, Y, and Z so they're not unduly exposed to this, right? And that's a practice that's common in any other type of insurance, right? My insurance company sent me a letter saying, hey, we used a drone. We flew over your house and we saw that your roof needs repairs, right? Now I was able to proactively repair the roof, keep insured, and now I've averted a problem in the future. So while that's not always one-to-one with how cyber insurance is going to work, I know when we work with clients in the range, it's always, hey, what does your cyber insurer say? Do you have that in place? All of the resources that they're going to be able to provide to you in terms of negotiating with a threat actor, the confidence to be able to recover, right? Sort of publicly as consumers anymore, we all accept that data breaches and security incidents happen, but how you recover is much more material to how your organization's perceived to protect your brand value and how customers respond to you in the future. So the insurers stepping in to provide that sort of after the fact, you can continue to operate your business seems to be a net positive at that, hey, this doesn't have to be a world-ending event for your business. At the end of the day, the threat actors are probably going to commit the crimes regardless, right? They're going to find a buyer for the data. This at least gives an organization some sort of structure to be able to respond and recover and sort of move past the negative event.
That's an extremely good point. And this is probably the only time in my life I will ever say this. I wish we could keep talking about insurance, but that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our panelists, Evelyn and Seth and Ryan, and our special guest, Chris Hay. A thank you to the viewers and the listeners. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there, and I guess watch out for agents spying on you.